for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 5 years has shared with us her extensive research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative, executive, and judicial processes in America. And now, Mae Brussel.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. I have 5 years of Dialogue Conspiracy on a weekly basis. This is number 224, and it's July 5th, 1976. I wanted to talk this week about a new book, which is currently in the bestseller list. It's called A Man Called Intrepid. I referred to it last week on Dialogue Conspiracy, written by Bill Stevenson. And I want to go into a description of that book and the comparison to the intelligence operations during World War II of British intelligence combined with the United States intelligence and the operations that are happening domestically as these agents combined forces with Chief of Hitler's Eastern Division Intelligence, Reinhard Gehlen, and began their operations domestically in the United States and turned away from the war against the Soviet Union first and then against Germany, and now are applying it to United States citizens. Before we get into A Man Called Intrepid, there were several other matters I wanted to share with you. There's another book that's out now that's very important. It's called The Control of Candy Jones. You may have heard her on KGO last week or read about her in the San Francisco Chronicle. It's a book written by Donald Bain, B-A-I-N. That book is out now. Candy was a model, New York City, an actress, a radio broadcaster. And in 1960, she was asked to deliver some messages for the Central Intelligence Agency. She had been used as a drop for the FBI for several years. And she felt it was patriotic. And besides that, she was broke. She needed money. So she consented to deliver messages. And she was directed to a doctor in the Oakland area of California who injected her and hypnotized her and gave her a fictitious personality to do errands for the CIA. In 1972, October 72, after the Watergate story began to fall apart, after the arrest of the Watergate Hotel, her last assignment was to see Jimmy Hoffa, and she then told the Central Intelligence Agency she didn't want to work for them any longer. At that point, she was again hypnotized and told to go to Miami and then the Bahamas, Paradise Island, to put her wristwatch inside of her shoes, not leave any note, put on her snorkel, and take a dive into this particular corner where there's a coral reef. And if she had obeyed these instructions, she would be dead. She would have killed herself or broken her neck and back. And the Central Intelligence Agency wanted this particular agent, who they had controlled with this double personality all these years, to commit suicide, and the record would show that she had done that and not link any of her contacts to the Watergate defendants or to Hoffa or the Central Intelligence Agency. Her husband, that she had married just a few months earlier, who came out and saved her life when he noticed what she was doing, is a famous radio personality in New York. His name is Long John Neville. And because he had studied many hours of hypnosis, about 100 hours with a famous doctor in New York City, he started to deprogram Candy and discover exactly what was happening to her. And they put together this book with tape recordings of her being deprogrammed in the process, by which she discovered that she was doing things totally against her will and wasn't even aware of them. The important thing, I think, is that she stated on the air that she's suing the Central Intelligence Agency because she stated that there's thousands of such people walking around like that today. She mentioned the Army, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the Health, Education, and Welfare have programmed literally thousands of human beings and experimented upon them and admitted that they were totally unsuspecting, just at a restaurant or a bar. Something was put in their food, they were taken to apartments and were experimented upon. And of course, we don't know who these thousands of people are, but they're in our midst. And I remember in January in 75 when there was a conference at Boston University, conspiracy conference, and I went back there and met the various researchers, and the thing that was important to me, the most importance at that time in American history and research, was not only who killed John Kennedy or Robert Kennedy or Martin Luther King, but the use of control of the mind to do the assassinations on the selected patsies and on other people at large in our society. The control of the mind is done by electrode implants, psychosurgery, drugs, and hypnosis. And I believe it has been used in the major assassinations that have taken place. The control of Candy Jones, as I say, is sold now. It's put out by Playboy Publishers. It's $8.95. And it's an important breakthrough in the era of mind control and government crimes by two prominent people who are now exposing this. And I bring this up not only because I think the book is terribly important and it's in conjunction with my research, but there's a matter in our local community which is taking place right now, which I wanted to share with you for a few minutes. And maybe you have leads that you can call me at home. My number's in the book, or call me at KLRB, or write to KLRB and see if you can help some people out who are concerned. And it fits in along these lines, maybe, possibly, with the story that Candy Jones is telling, or maybe when I get into A Man Called Intrepid, maybe this case fits in this category, and maybe it doesn't. But I'm going to share it with you, because a man named Michael Bohn, B-O-H-N, a local cartoonist who lives in Carmel, who incidentally was working right below KLRB, where we broadcast weekly, disappeared June the 16th. He left no trace at all, except that he telephoned a very close friend that he had seen the night before and the night before that, and he spoke with her in the morning, and he left his apartment, and he left his clothes. His car was in the shop where the motor was being fixed. Michael is 5'10", weighs 155 pounds, wears glasses, has dark hair, a beard, a mustache. He's a cartoonist and an artist, and he worked at a local store here painting, before painting canvases, and he worked for the Pine Cone downstairs doing layout work. June the 16th, he just faded away. He has no criminal record, no mysterious background, no history of drugs, no known hypnotist that was contacting him, although he, according to some of the information I have, has had contacts that are unknown to his best friends that were indicated on a calendar but were not known to his best friends. The maid saw him at the apartment June the 16th, and he disappeared. He had a calendar that 1976 that was marked, and every Sunday in June and July had a number on it, starting with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And the 8th Sunday, which is July 25th, on that date, there was written into this date, Step 3 completed, stop and maintain, which indicates that somewhere there's a Step 1 and 2, and nobody knows what that is. The local police are not concerned. There's been nothing about his disappearance in the newspaper. They're not taking it seriously. We've had a series of murders on this peninsula. I know of three couples that have been murdered in the last, two of them just recently, two couples, and another couple a year ago last Christmas. No links to these people have been exposed, no murderers found. I'm beginning to think that Carmel possibly is like the movie Jaws, where they didn't want to ruin the tourist industry by saying that the shark was swimming out by the beach. I think that there's a series of many, many unsolved murders and disappearances that are taking place, and I can come to my mind quite a long number, and I'm just beginning to wonder if we should add up what's happening here. But the reason I bring this up is that this is a time in this country where you have to keep your mind open to any possibilities. There's a news service last week that eight persons intimately connected to the Lockheed scandal in Japan have all died mysteriously, including two reporters, journalists looking into the matter, and businessmen, and eight people directly involved to that scandal, which just broke recently, are dead right now, involved with the Lockheed scandal. People are disappearing, and we can't separate boundaries of hippie or straight or Republican or Democrat. I think it's a community problem, and I bring it up because it is happening in other communities that play these tapes, too. It isn't an isolated problem, but I'm bringing it up because it's happening right here, and the young man happened to work right below where, as I say, we were broadcasting. We have to pull our information, and we have to ask ourselves some hard questions. I know that the police department was involved, Sheriff Peter Pitches' department, in suppressing what was happening at the Spahn Ranch when the Sharon Tate LaBianca murders were being prepared, the stages earlier where Charles Manson had links to the intelligence community where the police were protecting him. The police department in Dallas, Texas, Los Angeles, where Robert Kennedy was killed, in Laurel, Maryland, where Wallace was shot, or up at Chappaquiddick, or in Memphis, Tennessee, where Martin Luther King was killed were all involved, not the whole police department, but certain people in these major conspiracies. So we know that police departments have very good agents that give you protection, and some of them are very much involved in these cover-ups, such as they were in Santa Cruz before Mr. Mullen and Mr. Kemper were arrested with those massacres. We hear too much about being soft on criminals as solving crime, and we never hear much about being soft on law enforcement people or the Attorney General or the Director of the CIA or FBI, who are suppressing evidence from the people, large masses of people, that can be documented and it's available. Another thing that comes to mind is you have to study the history of Nazi Germany, and you have to learn how people from those communities disappeared one by one and never came back. And it isn't a question any longer of how can the CIA be allowed to dope or kidnap unsuspecting people or drug them or photograph them or study them and select them at random. It's a question of they are doing it. It's not how can they. It is documented that they've done it, and they've admitted that they're throwing the records away continuously of who they've done it to. We have to be alert. If anybody is taken off to a prison or a mental hospital or disappears, there is an explanation for it. In this case, there was no amnesia. If the gentleman had amnesia, he still had on him a driver's license. His bank book was left at home. His clothes were left back in Carmel. His car's in the shop. And there is no reasonable explanation right now about why Michael Bone has not been seen in over 20 days. This is June the 16th. He disappeared, and now it's July the 5th. We have to stop the disappearance of people and stop looking the other way, and we have to demand that our newspapers cover it, that our police department investigate it, and we have to have proof that they're investigating it instead of they're protecting these people, and we have to find out if there is any hanky-panky in these cases. Now, it may be that Michael Bone just decided that he wanted to go down to Big Sur for a month or go away to Colorado or take a trip, and he didn't notify anybody. He just left his clothes in the apartment and his car there. But that isn't a good way to disappear, because that leaves traces of him. If he just packed everything up and went, there'd be no reason to search for him. You'd think it was his own volition. But this person has disappeared, and they disappeared in Germany, and they disappeared when the intelligence community was testing them. And we have to consider again the calendar of step three completed, stop and maintain. If you've read enough books, as I have, on the intelligence community and the operations, you know that something is obviously wrong, and there is a very good chance that Michael could be in the control of another person. His income for the past few months has been dependent upon a couple who have, in quotes, loaned him several thousand dollars. He had a life insurance policy which actually didn't go into effect, but the beneficiaries were these people. He had no family that he named as the first beneficiary in this case, but this kind of thing with a car behind, with an attempted effort to make an insurance policy, the policy and another name and a calendar that's marked step three completed, stop and maintain, means that by the end of July 25th he had gone through step one and two, and we don't know what that is, but to me that indicates some kind of a control beyond his control. In terms of memory, I understand the night before he disappeared, he was recounting certain things that he had on cartoons, and his memory had gone. He couldn't remember the lines. And this is typical, according to a psychiatrist I spoke to this morning about this case, it's typical of somebody who does not have a memory loss, but who has something important on his mind that he can't share or reveal. Yet this Michael Bone left his bank books in Carmel, his clothes and his car, and just faded from the earth. And I think, as I say, we have to think about this. And if any of you have seen anyone by that description or know the person or worked with him and can offer any clues, please provide them. And I'll be glad to follow up with his friends who are concerned about this matter, as you can imagine. Now I want to talk about A Man Called Intrepid. You can get that at the bookstore or the library. As I said, it's written by William Stevenson, spelt with a S-T-E-V-E-N-S-O-N, but it's about a Stevenson spelt with the P-H in it, P-H-E-N-S-O-N. A Man Called Intrepid. It's the story of the combination of William Stevenson with Winston Churchill and Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, who knew in 1930s that Hitler, it was just being elected in 33, Hitler was, but that the German military was planning to rearm, and as early as 33, they knew that World War II would be coming. They had documents in their hands, and they began to develop codes of the Germans to break their system of warfare, and they tried to alert the Americans and British, who would have no part of the story, and probably because our major corporations were funding Hitler, 15 of them at least. And these men became alarmed and wanted a military system which was impossible to develop because the sympathies in this country were not against Adolf Hitler, so that the British intelligence and Roosevelt had to start a system of defense long before the American people and Congress realized that Hitler would declare war against the United States. And this book is a description of the methods that British and U.S. intelligence used to defeat Adolf Hitler in World War II. But it tells you more than that, because according to unpublished documents and manuscripts that I have, I received several unpublished documents, one called the Torbett document, which is terribly important to researchers. And it goes into the formation of our Central Intelligence Agency and the OSS, which was our American intelligence during World War II that became our CIA, and how we took Reinhard Gehlen, the chief of Hitler's intelligence, into our intelligence system along with British intelligence and set up headquarters in the Bahamas in order to continue a war against the Soviet Union. There were persons in our intelligence community who had no intention of coexisting with the Soviet Union when World War II was over. And the smartest thing they thought they could do would be to set up a system right then and there to counteract our former ally, which was the Soviet Union. One of those people involved was Bruce McDonald, who's written books on the John Kennedy assassination, who was a bodyguard for Goldwater during his attempt to run for president. And Bruce McDonald says in his book, The Blue Fox, that immediately when World War II was over, they realized that it would be impossible to get along with the Soviet Union. And therefore, Hitler's intelligence, British intelligence, headed by Mr. Stevenson and then Mr. Donovan, William Donovan of the OSS, and Alan Dulles of the CIA. He formed the CIA, and these men did set up their headquarters in the Bahamas. And I'm going to just run down for the next half hour some of the methods by which the intelligence system worked against Hitler, which I see they apply and can apply to us in the United States at the present time, because the techniques worked for them there, and they're working for them now. One of the important connections was that the headquarters for Intrepid, that was the code name for William Stevenson, were in England. One office was set out in the country in England, and the other office was at Rockefeller Center. And the big problem that William Stevenson found was that the man who was renting him the room in Rockefeller Center, Mr. Nelson Rockefeller, had strong ties to IG Farben in Nazi Germany, and that the very person who was loaning them that space for their intelligence operation was directly connected in many, many ways to IG Farben. Nelson Rockefeller had not only had close ties through Standard Oil, New Jersey, but at the time that Farben was doing his most diabolical work, Vice President, our present Vice President Rockefeller, had written a memo stating that he'd allow a partnership with the generals in Germany, whether or not the United States went in the war. Even if the United States went in the war, the Standard Oil and the Rockefellers would be in partner with our enemy, even if we were at war. And in this book, there's documentation, and he talks about, at that time, Farben was involved in concentration camps and mass extermination. Farben had a special intelligence section called NW7 that worked constantly with the German intelligence. That Standard Oil and Farben made an agreement as early as 1927, that Farben would stay out of the oil business if Rockefeller, owning Standard Oil, stayed away from their chemical business. And that gave Standard Oil a free hand from then until the present time, where they work with people like Mr. Sadat, who is in Nazi intelligence and now rules Egypt. Standard Oil would get a free hand with oil anywhere in the world and give Farben no global competition. They could do the chemicals if the Standard Oil could have a free hand with oil anywhere in the world. And I think this explains, if this contract was made in 1927, a man named Henry Kissinger came over from Germany with his family and his furniture in 1937. He began his intelligence work for military intelligence in the United States Army immediately as a youth. He was very young when he came here. He went to Harvard, where he got special training as a protege and worked always and constantly with Nelson Rockefeller. and goes around the world making his secret deals and oil contracts at the present time, still as Secretary of State. And his wife is still under the payroll of Nelson Rockefeller, Nancy Kissinger, and was under the payroll constantly of the Rockefellers. And if Rockefeller had agreements with FARB and German Nazi intelligence as early as 1927, when they were just forming their illegal rearmament of the world, you can see how Kissinger then could come over this country to continue the control of the war when the war was over. Standard Oil was given that free hand of oil anywhere in the world, and FARB in the chemical industry. And Nelson Rockefeller worked in those offices at Standard Oil at the time. And IG Farben was assigned some 2,000 foreign patents for their chemicals, and there was this collaboration of Farben with Standard Oil. The book goes into the links of the ITT to the Gestapo, and you may have read the book, The Sovereign State of the ITT. Also another interesting book that came out a few years ago, and it tells how the ITT made airplanes for Focke-Wulf. They built their bombers, and they carried messages, communications from the United States to the enemy on their cables, to Nazi Germany. At the time, they were our enemy during the war, through subsidiaries in South America, Chile, Cuba, Colombia, and Ecuador. The ITT owned the British Standard telephones and cables, and Mr. Sothen Ben knew of their German activities. Members of the Gestapo were board of the directors. A Man Called Intrepid talks about Harry Truman and the records that he kept, that Standard Oil was selling fuel to the Axis enemy at the time that we were at war. At the time we were at war against Nazi Germany in Venezuela, Rockefeller and his family gave the Germans preference in supervising their oil fields, and Standard Oil was considered, according to the espionage documents, a hostile and dangerous enemy to the United States. Their agency was serving the enemy of the United States. Farben and Rockefeller's and the ITT and 15 other corporations. You learn in this book about forgeries, and you can understand how the Alger Hiss case would come down after Alan Dulles had placed him on the Carnegie Foundation and with the original forming of the United Nations, and then they could yell communists are in the United Nations. They had a factory or a place where they worked, a location called X up in Canada, the United States and British intelligence. And in there they had every single typewriter that was ever made in the world, and they duplicated any typewriter in any way documents could be written on typewriters, and they were experts in planted documents and forgeries. And you could see when the Cold War was over why so many allegations that the Rosenbergs were prosecuted on forged documents, or Alger Hiss was prosecuted on forged documents. Just this last week there was a New York Times article, June 28, 1976, that the typewriter that was bought by Alger Hiss's father-in-law that he and his wife had allegedly used actually wasn't manufactured till 2 years after the FBI testified that it was purchased in the Alger Hiss case. And this new information comes out from the Freedom of Information Act. It was in the New York Times, a long article this week, that typewriter would have blown the whole case of Alger Hiss. He wouldn't have gone to jail for perjury. He didn't know about those typed papers that were picked out of the pumpkins. And you read about this duplication of any typewriter in the world used by the FBI, and it was absolutely perfect, the book said. The original manuscripts, after they forged something, and the things they took it from were thrown away, the typewriters would be dismantled and deep-sixed into the river. That might help to understand why, at the time of Watergate, it was suggested to the head of the FBI, L. Patrick Gray, the acting head, that he deep-six information that was in the Hunt, a desk of E. Howard Hunt. It would also explain the trouble in finding the typewriter that was used, the Woodstock typewriter, in finding that, the one that convicted Alger Hiss. But the forgery and the duplication of documents was absolutely perfected by William Stevenson and Bill Donovan, British and American intelligence, and then was used as a technique through the Cold War. A Man Called Intrepid talks about J. Edgar Hoover and his resistance to having an intelligence community in South America and Mexico. They said there was a rivalry between J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI, against Bill Donovan from the OSS and William Stevenson from British intelligence. Now, we don't think of J. Edgar Hoover as being international until you read documents like the Gemstone File, another unpublished document by Bruce Roberts, or the Torbett document, linking J. Edgar Hoover's connections to the racetrack, to organized crime, to the importation of narcotics and cocaine from South America and Argentina, and important personages whose names are you hear in the news all the time, such as Aristotle Onassis and Joe Kennedy, are named in these documents as using tankers to import these liquors after Prohibition, and people like Mr. Louis Rosenstiel went on to own Schenley and have large distilleries and had a foundation for J. Edgar Hoover with his co-worker, Mr. Nichols. You can see the links of J. Edgar Hoover to the Mexican Latin American connections, and they're terribly important, and these connections now are attempting to be destroyed. And Mr. Conin, who worked in Vietnam with E. Howard Hunt, was just out with a documentation last week, an article that he's been trying to get assassination teams to kill the narcotic leaders from Mexico that were involved prior to Watergate. And the important thing about this is that the CIA wants to kill their links not only to past Watergate experiences and political assassinations, but to the links of the Central Intelligence Agency to narcotics. And J. Edgar Hoover had a big role in this story, and that's why The Man Called Intrepid is important, because it shows Hoover's links to his fanatic determination that they shouldn't even look for Nazis down in Central America or South America. He resented the organization of Bill Donovan. He resented that they would have authority in South America. This is a quote from the book. Now, the quotation from the book said, "The first job of British intelligence was to knock out key German intelligence outposts in Mexico, which directed Nazi subversion and espionage in the United States and coordinated these activities with similar campaigns in Latin America." And in my research in the John Kennedy assassination, the links of Lee Harvey Oswald and his wife Marina were to Nazis who had links to the Nazi connections in Mexico City. And the CIA and Nazi-Mexican connections were important, and they related to J. Edgar Hoover, Division 5 of the FBI. I'm rattling off a few names here that just are important in connection to the main thought that there was an antagonism when the British intelligence and the CIA wanted to fight Nazis in Central, South America, and Mexico. And J. Edgar Hoover shouldn't have even been interested in that at all. But he was a big stumbling block, and he even began to break their cover to deter that the work they were doing to fight the Nazis. It was so important for him that J. Edgar Hoover attempted to break the cover of the British agents and the American agents to protect those Central American and South American links. A Man Called Intrepid goes into the use of psychics to predict planned assassinations, and how they'd have a famous psychic tell ahead of time that there was a horoscope. It would say Hitler's horoscope showed the planet of Neptune is in the house of death, and they suggest there'd be death around him, and they were really planning the murder of his most vile aide, Mr. Reinhard Heydrich. But they used the psychics to prepare people ahead of time. And then I look in my files of psychics, and I see that H.L. Hunt of Dallas, Texas, had contacts with Jean Dixon, and she would predict in her articles or on the air that John Kennedy was going to be killed. Jean has been very successful in predicting these major assassinations, and yet H.L. Hunt had direct contacts. His sons with people from military intelligence, Lamar Hunt, paid for an ad that Bernard Weissman and Larry Schmidt put in the paper the day that Kennedy was killed. A Mr. Rossi, who works in the Mercantile Bank, where Mr. Hunt had his offices, testified it was common knowledge that Kennedy was going to be killed in Dallas. The links of Jack Ruby with Connie Trammell at Mr. Hunt's office the Wednesday before the assassination are all important, because the name of Hunt and the link of the H.L. Hunt family and the oil people to the Kennedy assassination comes through many, many documents that the researchers have. And then you find stories that Mr. Hunt is in touch with Jean Dixon. And you wonder, does the psychic phenomena work in this country successfully on these assassinations? Because people who have direct links to those involved in the assassination also have direct links to the psychics. They predicted that Reinhard Heydrich was going to be killed. The psychics did that, so everybody's mind was set to that story. But the method of assassinating this man in Germany is not unlike the method of killing John Kennedy in Dallas, Texas, just a few years later. One of the plans was that two men would be the gunman. In the Kennedy case, there happened to be three. In A Man Called Intrepid, they describe the detailed plans of killing Mr. Heydrich, how they duplicate a village. They had experts in their field, and they had a position of a crossfire with a hairpin bend where the driver, the chauffeur, had to slow around the turn to take the turn, and thereby by shifting gears and slowing, which is what happened to John Kennedy's car when he made that turn from Maine and Houston onto Elm. He made those corners there and it slowed down the car. And this is the way assassinations were done in Nazi Germany. They also planned that their assassin in the Heydrich case would drop a coat and have false labels and confuse where he had been. For some reason, he was to drop a coat. And you remember when Lee Harvey Oswald is running, supposed to be Oswald, I know it wasn't, but the double, is running across a car lot after John Kennedy was killed and after Officer J.D. Tippit was killed. He conveniently drops a coat in a parking lot and leaving this little trace. The escape route over in Bavaria where they killed Heydrich was to hide in a church. The escape route for the assassins that killed Officer J.D. Tippit in Dallas, Texas was a church. Later, the two gunmen were flown out of town the next day. They hid in this church, and they were supposed to have been staying at the home of Tammy True, one of Jack Ruby's strippers. And when all the police left the area, they were taken out of the church. So you have a crossfire with several gunmen planned. You have them getting in position with maneuvers of the sharp turns of the particular place, the assassins leaving their coat and their false ID, and you have them hiding in a church, which is exactly the way it happened in Dallas, Texas. A man called Intrepid goes into the way they dispose of their agents. He discusses in detail a little bit about the disposal. One particular agent was hung in a jail in England. He was deported. Another way they did, they'd give them papers. Disposal squads were used, and what they would do would give a man a paper and tell him to go to Canada. He departed for Canada. He'd have an assignment, and it would say, "Depart for Canada." And then William Stevenson went on and said that was a fate more final than it seemed when it was written on the police blotter. If it said departed for Canada between somewhere where he was in Canada, he never arrived and he was killed, so that the method of following these operations would be concealed. An interesting murder took place in New York City, and of course, in the book that I want to do someday called Murderville USA, I've just been adding up these disappearances and these murders that literally run into the thousands. They describe in this book, page 270, that Ian Fleming, who was very much a part of British Navy intelligence and set up his headquarters down in the Bahamas with William Stevenson and Mr. Bill Donovan and Reinhard Gehlen, worked from Germany, but the headquarters are down in the Bahamas. Ian Fleming had two justifiable killings that he had to take care of. He was given a 00 classification, which is licensed to kill, and of course you know Ian Fleming as James Bond. He described these killings in Casino Royale, and it's interesting, I went into a used bookstore this week in Carmel to pick up something, and right on the table was Casino Royale, and I had just been reading about this, so I bought that book. I've been trying to collect them. But he describes in New York City at the RCA building in Rockefeller Center, there was a man from the Japanese intelligence, a cipher expert, and he had a room on the 36th floor. And in the same offices, same Rockefeller Center, is where the Intrepid offices were. And they felt that he was spying on American-British intelligence. So they located an office room in a next-door skyscraper facing this particular window on the 40th floor. And they could look across the street and see this Japanese agent working. So they describe, William Stevenson describes the job that Ian Fleming had. He got himself a couple of Remington 30-30s with a telescoping sight and with a silencer. And silencers are used in these assassinations, and telescopic sight was used when John Kennedy was killed. He brought another man with him whose job was solely to put a hole through the window so that he could shoot through it. And evidently, Ian Fleming was such a good shot that if one shot went through a window, he could follow and hit it right through the window. And he said the glass is very hard in New York City to keep the noise out, particularly at Rockefeller Center. They had some good, strong glass. But one agent from the 40th floor with a good scope shoots this gentleman, breaks the glass, and then Ian Fleming shot him through the mouth, and he was dead. We don't read about murders, silencers on the 36th floor of Rockefeller Center. It was written up in the book Casino Royale by James Bond. After he had done a lot of this work for British and American intelligence, he then went on to write novels and he was told by British intelligence, no one will believe you, because he was going to write stories about things that he had done for the intelligence community. And everything that you've seen in a James Bond movie or read in a James Bond book has done by British or American or combined intelligence. These operations take place exactly as they show them, and maybe if you see them next time, you'll think of them in those terms as being factual. And then he wrote about them afterwards, but they did take place. Another part of the book that's important is the use of drugs to make people sleepy. And they describe a particular woman, Agent Cynthia, and they're going to work with a crook. They need to break open a safe, and they also let men out of jail. And I know this has happened. James Earl Ray was allowed to leave jail, and he ended up in Memphis, Tennessee, as the patsy for the shooting of Martin Luther King. They used people that had been in jail, and they used a particular crook who was getting documents from a safe. And William Stevenson describes the drugs that they used. This is during World War II, and the CIA admitted that they were using these drugs right up through the 60s, admitted they were testing them from the 50s to 67. So after the tests were completed, how many more drugs are being used now? And that, again, gets back to the case of Michael that I brought up a little earlier. In A Man Called Intrepid, they tell about wanting to drug a night watchman to get into a particular safe, and they watched him and had drinks with him, and then put an undetectable sophophoric drug. It's spelled S-O-P-O-R-I-F-I-C, drug. It leaves no after effects. It causes the person who drinks it to get sleepy, after which they fall asleep. It reminds me of Chappaquiddick, where Mary Jo Kopechne left the cottage drowsy at 11 o'clock and was asleep in the back of the car when the car drove up away, or when Ted Kennedy wakes up and goes outside of his room across the bay and says, what time is it, with no indication that he was wet, or the famous politician from Germany, Otto John, who had something put in his coffee and was swept to East Germany and forced to say that he'd been a communist when he wasn't a communist. The use of drugs is common in the intelligence community. It's written up in A Man Called Intrepid, and I think it's important, again, because when people are missing and they just disappear, the best way, the surest way to make sure that they're not going to scream and yell is to have them drowsy, and the agencies use these, and it can explain later why they end up in a place and they don't understand how or why they got there. But drugs are described, and again, she describes how they let people out of jail in their spy work, and I know that they've been using it ever since. I wouldn't be so worried about A Man Called Intrepid if I didn't have documentation that William Stevenson then moved down to the Bahamas, where he formed with our American intelligence community and with Hitler's East of Intelligence, and if we didn't see a duplication. When you read this book, and I hope you read it, get it from the library and read it, A Man Called Intrepid, read the techniques used to win World War II, and then read the history of American intelligence after World War II, or the books like Reinhardt, Spy of the Century, and read how these people then combined forces and made a common enemy out of the Soviet Union that was our ally during those sensitive years during the war. And then read what's happening in this country every day and see how this team can use those same techniques against us. The book also goes into the Nazis and plague. There was no bubonic plague around Germany, but they used this as an excuse to round up families for the death camp. Captain Roland from the OSS had a brother who was a doctor, a Canadian physician, it's described in the book. He became a resident physician in New York City Hospital, and he would give agents leave for Europe. He would give them shots and inoculations. And once they said, why yellow fever inoculations if they're going to Europe? Why are they getting it? And the answer was that the Nazis often proclaimed widespread plague, that there were diseases there that they would let out. And they would say there's a widespread plague as an excuse to round up families and take them to the death camp. A doctor could come with a doctor's satchel, go to a house, say there's a plague, take the person away, and the person never appeared. Now think of that, and think of if you read about this wonderful flu vaccine that's coming overnight from Fort Dix. The President of the United States ordered that every American should have the flu vaccine, and there's been some things holding up and controversy of famous doctors now on whether we should have it or not. But think, if you're reading your daily papers, there's bubonic plague in the Midwest, there's bubonic plague in the Southwest. There was bubonic plague in Sacramento last week, and begin to save articles. I wish you could save as many as I do on these various subjects, like missing people or plague. But this was a technique used by the intelligence community, and Hitler used it. And an excuse for going in and taking certain people is that they had the plague. So in comes a doctor with a satchel, takes someone away, someone dies, and you're not going to do a cell count or test them. It's a wonderful way of having fear in a town. It is a wonderful way of getting rid of particular persons who are critical or suspicious of what's going on. It is a perfect way to disguise through ill health and spread the fear that other people will get it if they don't cooperate, because they're not sure, in fact, if it's taking place. And the intelligence community does have the vials to spread disease. They have vials of encephalitis and plague and flus in their containers now. They were ordered to destroy them. The President of the United States ordered to destroy them. They didn't destroy them. You haven't read about one person going to jail or being penalized. All we read about are new laws to protect anyone who discloses that they still have the drugs, but nobody has been punished for these drugs and for still having them. So I wonder if the German intelligence and the use of the plague is something that we're going to have. Our president has vetoed every domestic bill that has come his way, President Ford, ever since he's been president. When he was in Congress, he vetoed everything that had anything to do with health or welfare or education or really the benefits of a large mass of people in this country. And then on the basis of four cases at a military hospital, he gets on the floor of Congress, gets $153 million the next day, or $135 million, start the vaccine, make it, and gets us into the state of mind where we could all become victims of deadly diseases within the next year. Another thing Intrepid did was to create personality profiles of people. The British intelligence developed a technique originally which they taught Mr. Donovan and Alan Dulles of the CIA, combined with Hitler's intelligence, of psychological behavior patterns for random information gathered on any subject. And they called it sapography. Prosopography was the espionage name. It was based on a study by Ronald Seems on the Roman Revolution, Professor Ronald Seems. He studied the Augustus, the heir to Julius Caesar, who took over and established himself as a monarch, and he analyzed all of his henchmen and their family and their background and their social types, and he replaced the old senators and the businessmen with hand-picked supporters for a new ruling class. This happened at the time of the Romans, and the British intelligence made a study of this. And it takes you to the current Watergate problems when Daniel Ellsberg was going to be smeared, and Richard Nixon said, use any means necessary. And he sends CIA agent E. Howard Hunt to the CIA to speak to Dr. Malloy on a psychological profile. And what they can't get on Daniel Ellsberg, they go to his psychiatrist and they rob the offices so they can put down a profile of this man and create what he did based upon his fears or sexual fears or fantasies. His most personal feelings that he shares with the psychiatrist are photographed and given to Washington, D.C. to be delivered by the CIA. And this is the way somebody like Michael can disappear. I'm not saying that he won't appear within a week or two or that he is perfectly safe in one of his own volition. But somebody has to know a lot about this person, that he goes, leaves his bank book here, his clothes here, his job is waiting for him in Carmel. His car's in the shop, and he just goes off with some nondescript note about different phases that he's going through, and we don't know what those are. And we have to know that if anybody wanted him as a test or a profile, it's perfectly feasible that they could develop a story of a man, say, who was in ecology back in Colorado and comes to Carmel and owes some people money, and it's hard to get your cartoon syndicated, and you're dependent upon people. And when you're dependent upon people, you're vulnerable. And that's one reason why it's so important to have employment for everyone in this country so we don't fall into these traps. That's how Candy Jones fell into the trap in 1960. She was married and got divorced and had several children, and she needed the money. And the intelligence community knew she was pretty. They knew who she was. They had watched her for a long time. They knew she was getting a divorce. And they could come to her and say, do you need money? And she, yes, I need money. Well, will you deliver these messages for us? Yes, I'll deliver these messages for you. Will you take them to California? Yes, I'll take them to California. First, you have to see this doctor. And then the intravenous begins. How did it begin? Did they put that drug in her that made her drowsy, that the British and American and German intelligence have used? Did she then wake up and see the needle in her arm? She's written about it. She didn't know what she did for the Central Intelligence Agency. She still doesn't know. They told her to go off by herself and be alone or not see people while she was in the process of being programmed and to break off with her past contacts. That was part of her conditioning. And we read the political assassinations about loners being taken off, these political loners. And Candy was told to stay alone. So how do we know between fact and fiction what is a time to scream out and look for people like Michael Bone, how much we can help ourselves and help our society by ending this insanity? How much of these psychological profiles, which the commission exposed, the Rockefeller Commission talked about a little, and the drug testing, and Senator Church talked about a little in his report, but these psychological profiles come out through the Watergate testimony, the Senate Select Committee. It comes out in Candy Jones' case where she needed the money. It comes out in the case of Michael Bone and Carmel, who needed some money to pay rent or the payment on his car. The motor was fixed. How vulnerable are they, and how much do the people know, or why are they disappearing? I hope maybe next week that we'll know something about our own local community a little better. I think that even if he were to show up tomorrow, we'd still be worried about those other thousands of people walking around and not knowing who they are. And I think that Candy's exposing these things at a time has a direct link to books like A Man Called Intrepid. So I hope you read these books and go to your library and study these things. And if you have any information about these matters, write to me or call me, and we'll see if we can put our heads together and come to some conclusions about these. I'll see you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy. Stay well, and don't disappear, and take care of yourselves.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for many years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California.